Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up today, looking behind Pope Benedict's appeal to feed the world's hungry. We talk to a world food expert about what's spiking soaring food prices and who's hurting the most. And Lebanon's new president gets down to business amid renewed fighting in downtown Beirut. We have analysis on the challenges he faces. Pope Benedict appealed Sunday to the international community to help stem the world food crisis. Emer McCarthy has more.
Pope Benedict noted that the international community is struggling to resolve the increasingly grave problem of feeding the hungry. He said that many parents are barely able to provide food for themselves and their children. The Church, he continued, does not only pray to the Lord to give us this day our daily bread, but it is also committed to following his example of multiplying the 5 loaves and 2 fish with innumerable shared initiatives so that no one should ever go hungry.
The Holy Father's appeal comes as more and more of the world's people go to bed hungry at night. In a report released by the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, food today is at record costs, meaning those who have less have even less to eat than before. Rising food prices, the FAO says, are bound to worsen the already unacceptable level of food deprivation suffered by 854 million people. The FAO's secretary for the Intergovernmental Group on Grain, Abdul Abbasian, says countries must do a better job at looking ahead and planning world food supplies, because the rising prices we see today are not going away.
Prices are high. In fact, for many commodities, they are at the record. And we know that prices are high because last year production in many exporting countries were poor. Australia had a drought, stocks were low. And we also know that in the season that just behind us, we had a big increase in demand for industrial use of grains, such as maize for ethanol production. So these factors led to what we now name soaring prices. Looking ahead in this report, we look at the first production indications for 2008. And we saw that the wheat is going to be particularly good. We're going to get a bumper harvest in many parts of the world. And overall cereal production is forecast to increase by about 3.8% in 2008 compared to 2007. Now, in a normal year, if you had such a big increase in production, this would have been a very positive indeed. But this is not a normal year. Our stocks are still very low and demand goes very strong. Therefore, the increase may not be sufficient to bring down prices sufficiently, at least to levels that would be more comfortable. And this is the cause for concern. Now, the meeting that will take place here in June 3rd to 5th in FAO, where world leaders are going to come, the reason for it is that we think these problems that we are facing today and we faced last season are not problems that are going to go away by themselves, that we do need to invest in agriculture to make it sustainable and to make it to respond to this increased demand. Fuel is one of the new demands on agriculture, biofuel, that is, or biocarburant. Now, this new demand right now, especially as it comes from grains and from rapeseed, is certainly making its presence felt because we are having a scarce situation in terms of supply, and this scarcity has already given a rise to prices. So to have this additional demand, it can only make the situation worse. How much it has made it worse, it is very difficult to assess, but it's certainly a very important factor. It was last season, it will be next season. So the overall situation is that production is this year going to perhaps exceed utilization a little bit, but this is after 2 consecutive seasons of falling under it. So we do need more than 1 good season to recover, and that is in the short term. But we also need to look ahead, look at things that are going to happen. Our population, world population, is increasing. Climatic conditions and climatic changes are unfortunately promising to come in a few years, if not earlier. And all of these things means that we have to get prepared, because if this year, with this year of soaring prices, we were to have any major problems in the developing countries that were importing food, we would have had a terrible, perfect storm and a real food crisis in our hand. One of the things that went kind of unnoticed this season was that most of the crop problems actually occurred in exporting countries and not in importing countries. But usually, as we all know, these problems occur in developing and poorer countries, and this could happen any time. It could happen even in the current season. This is why we are not so perhaps optimistic about the level of the decline in prices in the coming season. And we want to be extremely, extremely cautious and tell the world, listen, you have to prepare yourself. You have no reserves, no buffer, and you really have to know what you're doing with what you produce. And you need to really think ahead, because in this game, if you don't think ahead, we could all be in crisis.
The irony is, as we heard, that world cereal output is expected to increase this year thanks to increased plantings and predictions of good weather. But even if harvests continue to be good, record low stocks need to be replenished, and the factors that shocked the system and brought on the global price surge are still there.
Really, it's not a question of food shortage. The big problem is food is there. In the rice market in the last few months, several exporting countries decided to have an export ban. Rice market is a very small market, 30 million ton in total. Rice is a commodity that is produced where it is consumed. So the little that makes it to the world market is in the hand of the few exporters. When these exporters decided, most of them, to ban exports, that sent rice prices to the roof. So it shows the importance of policy and how the policy decisions sometimes can cause a problem to basically prolong the problem. This is what has happened in the sector. So the food is there, but the distribution of this food is a problem. If you look at the food distribution, it's not just a question of who is producing it, who is exporting, who is importing. There is the issue of transport and freight. Freight rates are at record highs. So what has happened in the last few years is countries are trying to make negotiations with the neighboring countries to import food. Take, for example, Indonesia and China. Indonesia has become a huge market for wheat flour imported from China. When China decided to put restrictions on wheat flour, immediately the prices of wheat flour in Indonesia jumped twofold. And the only other place Indonesia could have got its wheat flour from was Australia, and yet Australia had a drought, didn't have enough supply. So the supplies are there, but distortions and restrictions have made the supply less available, and causing, therefore, a shortage. So it's a sort of an induced shortage that really shouldn't have been there. Many countries have reacted overreacted. A certain degree of panic seems to be spreading here and there. And these things have caused more problem than actually the actual supply situation, which is not so bad. As I mentioned, developing countries in 2007 had almost all, with the exception of Morocco and few countries here and there, had very good crops. 2007 for cereals was still a record year. So we shouldn't really have had these problems. But, you know, the fact that we did, it's an indication that there's something that is not right. And one of it is our trade policies. Another one is we just created this new demand called biofuels, but we haven't given it enough time to adjust. So it had come as a shock to the system, and it's been a shock that the system obviously could not handle in a short period of time. And the market reaction, price reaction has been quite extensive.
Abbasian says irrigation and farming technologies must be improved and made more available in developing countries for sustainable agriculture. And farmers should be given greater access to existing varieties of seeds. Genetically modified seeds, he says, are not a magic wand.
What is the problem with GMs is that many people perceive the current crisis as a way to promote the GM in the future. And the answer to it is that GM can be just one solution in many. It doesn't have to be the first thing you need, that is a GMC. There are still very good varieties of hybrid seeds available. Farmers don't have access to it, especially in poor countries. Or they have the seeds, they have no access to fertilizers. So without that, they're not going to increase their productivity. And then above it all, it's not all question about seeds and land. It's also a question of water. In Africa, only 44% of the continent is irrigated. So look, as the potential is probably four or five times more, if not more than that. So as long as we haven't made an investment in agriculture, it would be a little bit perhaps naive to all of a sudden say, well, okay, then GM is going to solve our problem. So without saying whether GM is good or bad, which we basically are completely neutral, and if technology is there, if it's a proven technology, then it can be used. But it is very difficult for us to say that it has to be the first option, because there are just so many other things that can be done in the meantime that hasn't yet been tried, because agriculture has been neglected for so long.
Sometimes the simplest things needed to promote sustainable agriculture are the most effective and the least costly. An officer for the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace, Monsignor James Reinert, recently returned from a trade and development meeting in Ghana, where he told me he had the chance to visit some villages where just a little bit of outside help can go far.
And the Holy See has spoken about this many times, the importance of energy for development, finding ways to power the industry, the life of the people, to move them forward. A simple light bulb. Places, we visited a village with no electricity. Life stops there when the sun goes down. You go into your little hut, and if you have the facilities to have a lamp or something like that, but to bring light, to bring electricity into the world of these people, that is will be a huge step forward for development for everyone.
What would it take, for example, to bring solar energy or something as simple as that, but which is a very expensive technology? However, it would make sense in Africa, which has so much sun most of the year.
All of those sorts of projects, the outlay of the capital, that's the thing that's holding them back. In this village that we visited, there's no running water, no clean water. The people have to go to a source. I'm not sure if there's a nearby river or what it is. But the priest who we met, who takes care of this and five other little villages or mission churches in the area, told us that for him, it cost $220 to sink a well. And when he gets $220, the next village gets their well. Something as simple as that. And you just have to kind of shrug your shoulders and say, then why not? Let's get the guy $1,000 to put in the five wells that they need. That's simple.
So why is the international community dragging its feet so much? If it doesn't cost that much for such simple technology, why aren't we doing more?
I guess it's just not so much we're not doing enough. We're not. But it's just not. It's trickling down, and it hasn't reached. Maybe that's a poor excuse. The fact that it would be so simple to bring water, to bring electricity into these remote areas, and not so remote, but into the country, into the villages where the people live, to power what they need for their lives. Something very simple. There's no easy answer, but having discussions like we had in Accra, those kind of things aren't just words. It makes people more aware. And once you see the problem, it does become easier to address it.
Some countries, including the EU, have favored developing nations by cutting or lowering import quotas and tariffs on their products, giving them a competitive edge.
I think that we're seeing more and more of that these days. One example, and again, from Accra, we visited a banana plantation and processing plant. It's a French company. They're employing people for the local community. They're shipping bananas into France and then go to other parts of Europe. It's all done tariff-free, and it enables the bananas to be exported and imported. A number of discussions about that took place in Accra, and I think that more and more countries are going to see the benefits of this, not only for themselves in receiving the goods, but they'll see the great benefit that is derived by the exporting country and being able to. The problem not just it's not just in tariffs, but also in subsidies, and that's a WTO question, and it wasn't addressed. It was discussed, but it wasn't addressed in Accra. So that's an ongoing discussion that has to be resolved.
You're talking about the subsidies of, say, European and American farming industry and other industries. How does that affect the developing world?
Well, the fact that they can't compete with the price, as simple as that we're not, in the United States, for example, they're not going to buy cotton from Mali at a higher price when it's subsidized in the United States. That's an example. Cereal grains, all of these things, the dairy industry here in Europe, there are so many things with that hold subsidies that have to be, it has to be discussed. Eliminated, I'm not sure, but it has something, it is something that has to be to be addressed.
Yeah, because, I mean, at the same time, here in Europe, there is a crisis in farming and agriculture. More people are moving into the cities for jobs, and the farming industry is suffering from all of that.
Well, not only that, we're seeing the problems in the developed countries, but the fact that it opens the markets for the developing world, and that cotton from Egypt or Mali or wherever it might be, Malawi, would be able to compete on the market. Other things, agricultural products, bananas. It's one of the things that came up so many times at the UN was the export and importation of bananas. So many countries depend on that simple of a crop, a one crop export, that if there are subsidies or high tariffs on imports, they can't sell what they have.
I went to the supermarket the other day and I saw that bananas, I'm not sure where they came from, but they were at €1.79 and in some places €1.99 per kilo, which seems to me a bit high. Is that because they've added tariffs to the import of these bananas?
I'm not sure if it's a tariff or the transportation costs, the price of fuel to ship those bananas to your supermarket here in Rome, that's probably a big chunk of it. From what I understand, the producer gets about 10 cents on a dollar for what he plants. The American farmer is an example. Well, if corn is twice the price that it was last year, he's making twice his profit. But it's still a very small percentage of what that price is and the increase. It has to be passed on somehow. Unfortunately, it's market driven. The consumer is the end of that chain. They're the ones that have to pay the price.
Well, as we all know from our thinning wallets, consumers are the ones who ultimately pay the price. But we asked the FAO's grain expert Abassian if there is something we don't know. Was there anything about his study of world food markets that he found surprising?
One of the striking things was this $1 trillion trade figure for 2008. This is not how much we spend on food. We spend far more than that for food. This is how much we spend in importing food. And just about a quarter of it goes to low-income food deficit countries. So this is quite a big figure and shows the magnitude. If you have $1 trillion, that is a 20% increase from last year. So, you know, there is a lot of capital involved and liquidity involved in this food sector. And this is perhaps one reason why lately it's becoming so much of attention even by investors. So food is not going to be cheap. That I think we have been saying for quite a while. But the question also is that it's not going to be a commodity once it was. That is really food and isolated from other commodities. Food is going to be part of a bigger picture. Because it's a part of a bigger picture, it has become extremely complex. You can no longer watch the weatherman and decide about the crops. You have to look at macroeconomics, finance, energy, transport. Because of the complexities around it, it involves so many things. And I think that we haven't been saying that enough. That, look, this is not just a question of FAO making a forecast for production and then wait and see whether it materializes or not. We have to make forecasts about many, many other things and then look at the implications and, you know, the spillover effects and so forth. And I think in the future reports of FAO, you will see more and more discussions about agriculture that are discussed in the context of other commodities, in the context of the energy market, in the context of the climatic conditions, changes, and so forth. So, I think the evidence to all of that is the huge and a very positive response we have received from world leaders to attend the meeting in Rome over food, which I think only 2 years ago it would have been very impossible to imagine that so many world leaders actually are willing to come to Rome and discuss food. So this alone, I think, is extremely important.
Abdul Abbasian is the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization's secretary for the Intergovernmental Group on Grain. Well, if soaring prices make it increasingly difficult for families to put dinner on the table, aid agencies, too, are having to cut back their food assistance because their stocks simply cost more. The World Food Program says they're going to have to cut food rations for hundreds of thousands of people in Africa after June, and some 500,000 people in Iraq are likely to lose aid, too. Just some more food for thought the next time you're biting into a mega meal. Clashes erupted Monday night in Beirut, injuring about a dozen people. The violence followed the swearing-in on Sunday of Lebanon's new president, Army General Michel Sliman, who now fills the office, which has been empty since President Emil Lahoud stepped down last November. Lebanon has been embroiled in political turmoil, and state institutions have been paralyzed for the last 18 months, following a deadly war between Israel and Hezbollah in the summer of 2006. Lebanon once again seemed on the brink of civil war just 2 weeks ago, when Hezbollah seized large parts of Beirut and routed government supporters. At least 81 people were killed, and people feared a repeat of the civil strife that pitted the country's 17 different faith communities against each other just a decade ago. President Sliman's election was part of an agreement brokered in Qatar last week, aimed at defusing the crisis. He is expected to appoint a prime minister on Wednesday to head a new cabinet, after he consults with lawmakers on their choice for a prime minister. The parliamentary majority is expected to nominate its leader, Saad al-Hariri, or current Prime Minister Fuad Siniora. The premier must be a Sunni, according to Lebanon's sectarian power-sharing system. Well, Professor Khalil Karam of St. Joseph's University in Beirut told us about some of the challenges facing the new Lebanese president.
According to the constitution, since 1989, the president doesn't have a lot of tools in his hand, constitutional tools. But everything depends on the personality of the person, of his strengths, etc. That's why we expect a lot from this president, who is coming with a big consensus and a big international and regional and Arab support. So people are expecting a lot.
Professor Karam told Kelsey Brennan Wessels that in his acceptance speech Sunday, President Sliman was careful not to make promises he might not be able to keep.
He asked for diplomatic relations between Lebanon and Syria. He asked that the Lebanese diaspora, which has a majority of Christians, can get the Lebanese nationality, the Lebanese passport, that the International Tribunal for the President Hariri assassination has to be supported and has to be implemented. Concerning the arms of Hezbollah, that this should be a part of a wider dialogue and not to be not to use force to solve this issue. And the relations with Syria, of course, he said diplomatic relations plus to normalize the relations with Syria, knowing that the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Syria was present.
Right, and going back to the problem of the Hezbollah's weapons, how do you think the new president will address this problem?
And when he was commander-in-chief, he was in very good terms with the Hezbollah. This means that he might be the right person to begin this dialogue. He is sure, and we all are sure, that it's not going to be a push-button decision. It's going to be a long discussion that will take into consideration the evolution of the peace talks in the Middle East and the relations between Iran and the United States and all these issues, which have nothing to do with Lebanon directly, but they will alter, in a way, the solution of some problems like the arms of Hezbollah. The Hezbollah does not know yet if it will be part of it. The only government was in was the last Senora government. And before that was very reluctant to participate directly, used to send his friends or allies to be there. It's still vague. It's not clear.
Is civil war still a fear in Lebanon, or has this election solved this issue?
No, it's calmed down. There is a stabilization now. And we're going to have a very long period of discussions about this issue, the electoral law issue, and several things that were not settled by the Senora government because it was completely blocked.
All right, can you talk a little bit about the ability of the president to keep the army unified?
Yes, this is definite. I think it went through very bad experiences, and it did not explode like, let's say, 30 or 20 years ago. So I think he will be capable of at least doing this very important and delicate question. He didn't accept that the army be part of any of those partisan clashes we had since 2005. And he succeeded in that. And this was, I think, one of the major assets he had in order to become president, and all the interior and external forces decided that he will be the consensus president. It was the issue of the army that in 2005 it didn't break, 2006, 2007, and lately, 2 weeks ago, when the problems happened between the Shiite and the Sunni factions, the army stood still.
Right, now the elections next year, it is said that Christians are to be the ones who will determine the winners and the losers. How is that possible?
In Lebanon, the Christian role right now can be very important for the future of the country, because the Christian group now is in between the Sunni and the Shiites. And this is a historical role to bring together all the factions, the Muslim factions in Lebanon, if we have a wise Christian policy. And we think that with this president, knowing his experience in the army that has a lot of Shiite and Sunni, so he knows how is the chemistry of bringing these people together. So the role of the Christians will be much more important than their number this time. It has never been that way, because long time ago we used to consider the Muslim component of the country, not the Sunni and the Shiite. Now we are considering the two components of the Muslim community. So this is a very important role for the Christians to play in order to bring them together, and that all together we think the future of Lebanon is in dialogue, in tolerance, in democracy, in pluralistic values, etc.
And thanks there to Khalil Karam, a professor of international relations at St. Joseph's University in Beirut. And that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. Laudator Jesus Christus.